Thank you, Howard. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Andrew Rushton from the CMS Innovation Center, and I will be serving as the moderator for this webinar on the Healthcare Innovation Awards Round 2, with specific focus on Categories 1 and 2. Before we proceed, there are a few important housekeeping items to address. This webinar is being recorded, and slides and transcripts of this webinar will be posted to the Innovation Center's website within the next week. If you are a member of the press, this webinar is off the record, and if you have a question, please email press@cms.hhs.gov or call 202-690-6145. Furthermore, it should be noted that the comments made on this call are offered only for general informational and educational purposes. The Innovation Center's comments are not offered and do not constitute legal advice or legal opinions, and no statement made on this call will preclude the agency and or its law enforcement partners from enforcing any and all applicable laws, rules, and regulations. Applicants are responsible for ensuring that their actions fully comply with applicable laws, rules, and regulations, and we encourage you to consult with your own legal counsel to ensure such compliance. Furthermore, to the extent that we may seek to gather facts and information from you during this call, we intend to gather your individual input. The Innovation Center is not seeking group advice. The main purpose of today's webinar is to focus on Categories 1 and 2 of the Healthcare Innovation Awards Round 2. Subject matter experts will be presenting information relevant to Categories 1 and 2 in addition to being available to answer questions. The agenda for this webinar is a hefty one, so I will provide a brief overview now for our attendees. After I conclude my remarks, Sheila Hanley, Group Director of the Policy and Programs Group at the Innovation Center, will discuss goals and success measurement. Mike Rapp, Senior Advisor at the Innovation Center, will start speaking on Innovation Category 1 and include John Kane, Senior Analyst for the Division of Institutional Post-Acute Care, John McGinnis, Director of the Division of Outpatient Care, both from the Centers for Medicare, and Joseph Hutter, Lieutenant Commander in the United States Public Health Service. Mark Wynn, Senior Analyst with the Innovation Center's Demonstration Group, will review Innovation Category 2. Following him will be Brian Samuels, Commissioner of the Administration on Children, Youth, and Families, Mimi Toomey, Director of the Office of Policy Analysis and Development at the Administration for Community Living, and Suzanne Fields, Senior Advisor on Healthcare Financing at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. Immediately following the Category 2 presentation, a question and answer session will conclude the webinar. During the question and answer session, questions will only be accepted through the Submit Your Questions box that is located on the lower left of the webinar portal appearing on your computer screen. Please note that no questions will be accepted by phone. If you do have questions that we are not able to answer on this webinar, you can always email us at innovationawards@cms.hhs.gov. Again, that's innovationawards@cms.hhs.gov. Lastly, the Innovation Center will be doing further webinars on the Healthcare Innovation Awards Round 2. More information will be forthcoming on how to register for these webinars through the Innovation Center website and listserv. And with that, I will turn it over to my colleague, Sheila Hanley. Sheila?
Hello, everyone, and thanks very much for joining us this afternoon. This is the second in a series of 8 webinars we'll be offering to support applicants for Round 2 of the Healthcare Innovation Awards. I'm Sheila Hanley with the Healthcare Innovation Awards team, and I'd like to take just a moment to set the stage for this afternoon's discussion. As you may know, the mission of the Innovation Center is to test innovative payment and delivery models with the objective of reducing expenditures for Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP. CMS appreciates that there is extraordinary innovation in delivery system and payment approaches occurring across every corner of our country. The Healthcare Innovation Awards are designed as a partnership with you as innovators in the field to collaborate in testing new service delivery and payment models that hold promise for achieving better care and lower costs for Medicare, Medicaid, and SHIP enrollees. In our first round of the Healthcare Innovation Awards that was announced in November of 2011, we funded 107 tests, selecting those with the greatest chance of delivering better care at lower cost and that had the greatest chance of creating larger scale, sustainable results. The awardees from the first round of the Healthcare Innovation Awards are doing extraordinary work and have begun to impact care and cost across a broad cross-section of services within diverse communities in urban and rural areas in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico. In round two of the Healthcare Innovation Awards, we hope again to build off the best innovations occurring in the field, but to do so targeting priority areas in key categories. The objective of round two of the Innovation Awards is to expand our partnership with innovators in the field so we can identify new payment and service delivery models in four specific categories and to develop a clear pathway to new Medicare, Medicaid, and SHIP payment models for these service delivery models. As in the first round, we're looking to engage a very broad cross-section of healthcare stakeholders, including hospital systems, integrated systems that include physicians and others, multi-specialty medical groups, large or small, post-acute providers of all types, SNFs, nursing home, rehab facilities, home health, et cetera, and many other types of providers in addition to state and local governments, business, communities, academic and research organizations, labor, and other eligible organizations interested in achieving better care and lower cost. We will measure the success of the projects we select in round two based on the ability of these initiatives to rapidly reduce costs for Medicare, Medicaid, and/or CHIP beneficiaries, and their ability to improve care for populations with specialized needs, such as children in foster care or people living with HIV. Success will also be measured on their ability to rapidly transform financial and clinical models for specific types of providers, and again, we anticipate a broad range of providers, and to improve the health of populations through prevention and linkages between clinical care with community-based interventions. We're looking to the field for true innovations in service delivery and payment approaches or business models that will help us to achieve these results. Round two of the Healthcare Innovation Awards focuses on supporting innovative models in four areas, models that rapidly reduce costs for Medicare, Medicaid beneficiaries, in the outpatient or post-acute settings, models that improve care for populations with specialized needs, models that can quickly transform financial and clinical models for specific types of providers, including, for example, oncologists and cardiologists and other specialists and subspecialists, but potentially other types of providers as well, and models that improve the health of populations through prevention and linkages of clinical medicine to community-based services. In today's webinar, we are focusing on the first two innovation categories, models that rapidly reduce costs for Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP beneficiaries in the outpatient or post-acute setting, and models that improve care for populations with specialized needs. We're fortunate to have with us today subject matter experts from across CMS and HHS, in addition to our Innovation Center team. Each speaker will be providing contextual information on these categories and priority areas, including a brief explanation of each category and several of the priority areas, some very high-level descriptive information about the population or services in each category, and, importantly, the rationale for why we're seeking innovation in these categories. As we provide examples of types of services, types of providers and delivery system and payment issues, please be mindful that the examples described in today's webinar are illustrative only and not intended to convey a preference or preferred approach. We also want you to be mindful that applicants will be asked in the LOI and in the application to identify a primary innovation category. Applicants have the option of using narrative sections of the application to describe how their models may impact other categories or priority areas if they choose to do so. We also want to remind you that to support sustainability of interventions, applicants will be asked to propose a payment or business model to support their proposed service delivery model. And last and importantly, we want to thank you for the innovative and important work you do each day to make care better and more affordable. We look forward to partnering with you in round two of the Healthcare Innovation Awards. I'd like to now introduce my colleague, Dr. Mike Rapp.
Thank you, Sheila. As Sheila indicated, I'm Michael Rapp, a senior advisor in the Office of the Director here in the Innovation Center. I am joined by colleagues from the Center for Medicare and the Center for Clinical Standards and Quality who have already been introduced, John Kane from the Center for Medicare, Dr. John McGinnis from also the Center for Medicare, and Dr. Joseph Hunter from the Center for Clinical Standards and Quality. They will be speaking about particular areas. So category one, as Sheila indicated, and as this slide shows, is the outpatient and or post-acute settings. And within this broader category, there are particular priority areas which are listed here. As Sheila indicated, priority means that preference will be given to submissions for these areas. However, CMS will consider submissions in other outpatient and or post-acute areas within this category. So the next slide, we talk about, well, why did we pick these areas? And there are three important reasons listed here. First is growth in spending. As some subsequent slides will indicate, outpatient spending is larger than and growing more rapidly than inpatient setting spending. The next reason is geographic variation. And here, one will find that post-acute spending is the biggest contributor to geographic spending variation. And finally, we're trying to balance our portfolio, which is well-developed in the inpatient settings. So now I'd like to turn to some slides that will illustrate this point, these points, and you'll see here the Medicare overall spending. So for Part A, which covers the inpatient services, you see that's about a third or so of the overall spending. Part B, which covers the outpatient arena, Medicare Advantage, which covers both, and then Part D for prescription drugs. The next slide, you'll see where the acute inpatient spending is demonstrated with the blue color on the bottom. So this is the inpatient hospital. And as you can see on this slide, the growth here is relatively flat. Compare that with the red portion of the bar graphs, which shows the skilled nursing facilities. So that's the post-acute and shows that relative to the inpatient, inpatient hospital, there is more growth. The next slide shows the Part B or the outpatient overall. And what you will see here is that there is a general growth here, but particularly if you look at the purple portion there in the outpatient hospital area, that has grown more rapidly. And the next slide will show more specifically what the per beneficiary per month growth has been over the last several years. And as you see, that for outpatient hospital is around 42%. The sort of norm is around 14%. Inpatient hospital, you'll see here, is only 5%. So that is quite different than the outpatient area. Hospice also has grown significantly with 31%. The growth in terms of the volume is not dramatic for the skilled nursing facility or home health, these post-acute areas, but as you'll hear in a second, there is quite a bit of geographic variation in these. And so for this next couple of slides, I'll turn it over to John Kane.
Thank you, Mike. Slides 15 and 16 provide an additional example of the type of variation that we have witnessed in our nation's health spending and why we feel that post-acute care is among those areas deserving of focus. The example on slide 15 is specific to Medicare spending in 2010 for MS-DRG 291, or heart failure and shock with major complications. As you can see, the inpatient spending on this chart is stable across the five different locations. The spending areas that are driving the variation among the different locations come most notably from post-acute care spending and readmissions. Slide 16 looks more in depth at the post-acute spending identified in slide 15 by each of the various post-acute settings. And what we see is that variation in the utilization of particular settings, such as skilled nursing facilities, for example, drives the variation in payments. This is obviously just one example, but we have seen familiar and similar trends with other diagnosis groups, whereby the variation in post-acute spending and readmissions is primarily responsible for driving increased costs to both the insurer and the beneficiary. I'll now turn it back over to Mike to provide greater clarity on what we mean when we speak of the outpatient and post-acute settings.
The next slide shows generally what is included in the outpatient and post-acute setting. So as stated in the funding opportunity award announcement, the proposal that one submits needs to indicate which innovation category the model falls within, as well as which priority areas, if any, are addressed. So what we're going to try to do now for you is really define what falls within these categories. In the outpatient settings, of course, a large component of it and the largest growth area is what I already mentioned, and that is the hospital outpatient area. In addition, the specific priority areas or some of the specific priority areas are outpatient as well. And while we exclude acute inpatient care as a principal focus of the Round 2 awards, we do not exclude all inpatient care. With regard to the post-acute settings, the inpatient rehabilitation facilities, the skilled nursing facilities, and long-term care hospitals specifically are, of course, inpatient facilities. The home health agencies are not. Now, I do want to mention one other thing, too, that we don't have it listed on the slide, but hospice is considered one of the post-acute settings or post-acute service as we get to the priority areas. So in the next several slides, we will discuss the priority areas and give examples of them, settings for these services, and some payment and service delivery issues. As we talk about them, we will use Medicare examples. But as Sheila indicated, we want to reiterate that an important focus of these awards is Medicaid and CHIP. So consider these service delivery and payment issues only as examples. Now for the first two priority areas, I'll turn it over to Joe Hutter for Diagnostic Services and Outpatient Radiology.
So on slide 18, at Category 1, those first two priorities as mentioned were Diagnostic Services and Outpatient Radiology. Examples would include radiology and other imaging, EKGs, cardiac monitoring, and laboratory tests. Examples of settings include hospital outpatient, ambulatory surgical centers, physician offices, skilled nursing facility outpatients, and independent diagnostic testing facilities. As for payment and service delivery issues, we'll use radiology as an example because it's the biggest sandbox within diagnostic services. A better term, perhaps, than radiology would be imaging, as other specialists do imaging as well. Imaging is important, but it has special challenges. First and foremost, it's a cross-cutting clinical service. In a bundle for, say, CABG or hip replacement, the central players are all internal to the bundle. It's a contained box, more or less. In imaging, there are multiple players operating in multiple boxes. For instance, physicians of every type will order the studies. There's a technical arm that produces the images, a professional arm that then interprets them. On the payment side, there are technical fees, which is the lion's share, separate professional fees, and sometimes these are combined into global fees. A second factor, which really more is an opportunity than an obstacle, is that operationally, there is no set wall between outpatient and inpatient imaging. What I mean by this is that any delivery system model that improves the efficiency, quality, and or safety of outpatient imaging will generally apply to inpatient imaging as well. Also, any improved communication, data sharing, shared decision making, or decision support tools would ideally involve prior studies, regardless of which setting these studies were obtained in. Now, as for imaging system level problems to be solved, you tell us what the problems are, but here's three well-known examples. First, inappropriate use. Some say that as much as 30% of all imaging is unnecessary. Second would be duplication of the same test, as generally there is little sharing of studies at the local or regional level. Third, stacking of tests, which refers to multiple different tests when perhaps one would do. Some well-known delivery system reforms, and here again, these are just examples, come up with your own, include things like, one, continuous quality improvement, using evidence-based clinical guidelines to identify and eliminate waste, lean processes, which represent the latest variation of the QI theme, computer-based decision support tools for ordering physicians as well as for imagers, and finally, HIT systems that track and share information and could allow for expert consults at the local and regional levels and across the spectrum of care.
Thank you, Joe. So the next one of the priority areas that we'll discuss is physician-administered drugs. And this does, in terms of examples, tie directly into the Medicare program, where physician-administered drugs are covered under Part B of our program. They're different than prescription drugs, which are covered under Part D. So there's certain requirements for physician-administered drugs, principally that they be normally not something that is self-administered, so it's not something that the patient can take care of for themselves. So this is the coverage limitation. If you deal with the Medicaid or CHIP program, this is not how the coverage is organized. And so at any rate, this is by way of example, but in the Medicare program, examples of physician-administered drugs would include the things listed here, chemotherapy, rheumatology or ophthalmologic drugs, certain vaccines, and erythrocyte-stimulating agents. And these physician-administered drugs can be administered or obtained in a variety of settings, and they are listed here, including physician offices, pharmacy, durable medical equipment suppliers, and so forth. I won't read through each one of them. And instead, I'd like to just address some of the payment and service delivery issues that are encountered. A principal one of these is the drug pricing. So the medication is physician-administered, so the physician, if they're going to do this in their office, has to obtain the medication. So how do they do that? They purchase it. And so when they purchase it, then how will it be paid for under Medicare? So this has caused quite a bit of issues in terms of whether the payments were more than they should have been, and there was some changes to this in the last several years. But that still continues to be somewhat of an issue as to exactly how much the physicians would be paid for the medication and how much profit, if you will, might be built into that. And the second component of it is to paying for the actual administration of the medication, so there are certain fees built in that. But the kind of the overall context of this is, okay, when you have a situation like this where they're covered only in this particular category, how do you deal with these sorts of issues? And are there different approaches, both in terms of service delivery and in terms of payment that might be useful and might deal with the principal goals, which we have, are to reduce costs while improving or maintaining quality. Now, I'm going to turn it back over to John Kane.
Thanks, Mike. Home-based services represent perhaps one of the more unique service categories in that the services are provided to the patient right in the patient's home. That being said, some of the service and delivery issues in home health are similar to those of post-acute more broadly. For example, home health payments under Medicare are tied to the volume of services, whereby payments may be augmented by the number of therapy visits provided to the resident. As a result, some home health providers may focus on these payment incentives inherent in the system rather than what is best for the patient. Similarly, With regard to post-acute services generally, we see that payment incentives can drive the type of care provided. For example, you might see the same patient with the same illness and requiring the same basic treatment in various post-acute settings, such as a rehab patient in a skilled nursing facility and in an inpatient rehabilitation facility. Though you might find that the care provided in these settings is vastly different merely on the basis of differential payment incentives that can drive how much and what type of therapy the patient receives and how long the patient is kept within the care setting. This, along with avoidable hospital readmissions, hint at the potential for poor care coordination among post-acute providers and between the hospital and post-acute settings, which ultimately means that the one suffering the most is the patient. Obviously, these are just a few examples of potential service and delivery issues within post-acute care, but they all hint at more global and systemic roadblocks in our push toward improved health and healthcare at lower costs. I will now turn the call over to Dr. John McInnes to discuss therapeutic outpatient services.
Hi, John McInnes, Division of Outpatient Care. The next category of services are described here generally as therapeutic outpatient services, and these primarily refer to surgical procedures and radiation therapy in all the different varieties. And the settings that we're referring to in terms of outpatient in this context refer to the hospital outpatient department, ambulatory surgery centers, and the physician office. These are typically viewed as three different levels, with physician office being sort of the lowest level of intensity, ambulatory surgery center in the middle, and the hospital outpatient department at the top. Typically, the payments in the hospital outpatient department will be, they're always higher than the ambulatory surgery center in most cases, but in not in all cases, higher than the physician office setting for the same surgical procedure. In terms of some of the service delivery and payment issues that we're interested in and others are interested in, as one Dr. Rapp showed in a prior slide, in terms of these different payment systems, the hospital outpatient department or the outpatient prospective payment system, payments from 2008 to 2012 have exploded in the hospital outpatient significantly as compared to other areas, particularly the inpatient. And this is due to advances in technology, but other reasons which we're actively working on. In terms of the payments in the hospital outpatient department, they're really sort of an intermediate. Hospital outpatient is a prospective payment system. It's not as much of a prospective payment system as the DRG payment system, but it's also not a fee schedule like the physician fee schedule where payments are made, individual payments for each coded procedure. It's sort of intermediate. These payment groupings are called ambulatory payment classifications. There is payment for service. It's generally not based on outcomes or efficiency, although there is a penalty for hospitals that fail to satisfy quality reporting standards. And finally, the last bullet on slide 22 refers to an issue that has gathered much attention recently, and that is of hospitals typically buying either surgery centers or physician practices and converting them into off-campus provider-based facilities and then capturing the higher payments that go with being a hospital, but in some cases, as reported, providing basically the same services that the physician offices were offering prior to that change in ownership. So that's been an area of interest. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Dr. Rapp.
Thank you, John. So we are at the end of our discussion of Category 1, but I would just like to spend a couple of moments sort of summarizing what we were hoping to provide for you here. As we've indicated, it's important for you to indicate which categories your proposal would fit into and also what priority areas, if any. So we wanted to be sure that we defined clearly for you what those were. So our general overall categories are outpatient and post-acute settings, but within those, there are these priority areas. One, in the outpatient arena, we've got diagnostic services, but we've also got therapeutic services. So anything considered therapeutic would be included in there. So it includes physical therapy, speech and language therapy, occupational therapy, but also other therapeutic services like surgery and so forth. So it's important to really recognize how broad those priority areas are. Secondly, we've listed even more specifically certain areas in the outpatient arena, such as outpatient radiology, high-cost physician-administered drugs, and as I mentioned, therapeutic services. Within the post-acute setting, it includes all of the usual post-acute settings that we think about, and it also includes hospice, although we do not have that indicated on the slides. Even so, although the priority areas are important and important for you to know in terms of being able to define it, CMS will, of course, consider submissions in other outpatient and or post-acute areas within this category. So with that, I will now turn it back.
Great. Thank you. Now, before we proceed, just have a quick technical update. We understand some attendees may be having some difficulty viewing the slides on their computer. We suggest pressing the F5 button on your computer keyboard, and that should alleviate the problem. Again, if you're having some trouble seeing the slides, press F5 on your computer keyboard. Next up as we move along is Mark Nguyen, Senior Analyst from the Innovation Center's Demonstration Group. Mark, it's all yours.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I'd like to briefly discuss Category 2, Improving Care for Populations with Specialized Needs. First, I'll run over the priority areas and then talk about the first four of the priority areas in a little bit more detail before turning the presentation over to colleagues from other agencies to describe the final priority areas. So the priority areas are pediatric populations that require high-cost services, persons with Alzheimer's disease, persons living with HIV/AIDS, children at high risk for dental disease, children in foster care, adolescents in crisis, persons requiring long-term supports and services, persons with serious behavioral health needs. And just as Mike Rapp mentioned for the Category 1, we will also consider submissions that improve care for other populations with specialized needs, although these are our priority areas. Why are these areas specified? Well, first of all, we believe there's a high unmet need in these areas, significant opportunities to improve care. Secondly, we've seen significant growth in spending in these areas, especially for those populations with complex care needs and in relationship, for example, with inpatient hospital where the growth has been a little bit less. Third, we think there's a need for delivery systems change, that is, a need for significant amounts of policy work to integrate healthcare models and payment models together in appropriate manners. And finally, in comparison with other work that the Innovation Center is already sponsoring, we believe that there is a need for portfolio expansion into some of these areas so that we can create a new model to test and cover these patient populations. So the first of these areas, then, is pediatric populations that require high-cost services. This population includes children with multiple medical conditions, behavioral health issues, congenital diseases, chronic respiratory diseases, complex social issues, and in all too many cases, combinations of all of these things. We know that Medicaid and CHIP pay for about half of both the pediatric ambulatory care visits and inpatient care for children. So this is a huge issue for the Medicaid and CHIP programs. Examples of cost drivers include lack of integration of care across settings, social determinants of health, which are inadequate, inappropriate use of specialists, where we believe that primary care services can provide a better integrated and overall type of care for the patients, and fragmentation of services, for example, services provided by physical and occupational therapists in relationship with developmental psychologists. Examples of opportunities in this area include
improving early screening, assessment, and diagnosis, increasing compliance to care plans, coordination of community settings, slowing the progression of chronic diseases, and of reducing avoidable services that, especially those including hospitalizations, readmissions, and as just mentioned, actually outpatient hospitalizations as well. Next category is persons treatments of persons with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. This population is a huge and difficult population to deal with. Something like 5 million people currently have Alzheimer's, with the large majority of these cases diseases that occur after age 60. According to recent statistics, about 13% of men and women age 65 and older have Alzheimer's disease, and there's an increasing incidence of that disease for the very old. Groups that are challenged especially by Alzheimer's disease include racial and ethnic minorities, people that start with intellectual disabilities in the first place, and it's especially difficult for persons with a younger onset of the disease before age 60. Cost drivers can include a number of things, but that includes the fact that care is not always provided in settings that are best for the beneficiaries, including home and community care, as opposed to institutional care, and that in many cases, providers may be providing duplicate services that are not properly coordinated. Opportunities in this area include the possibility of implementing new models of care for these patients, focusing on identifying those with these diseases, specialized dementia care, and better care coordination, and finally, an area which needs a lot of attention, caregiver support. The next category is persons living with HIV and AIDS. This description includes of the population includes nearly half of the people who have HIV/AIDS receive their regular care under the Medicaid program. So this is an especially important area for the CMS attention. Many people who are living with HIV and AIDS historically have had inadequate access to care and may be coming from disadvantaged social classes and areas. Some of the cost drivers include uncoordinated care, the need for better integration of behavioral health care, and unmet needs for other types of social supports. Opportunities in this area include improving early screening, diagnosis, and treatment, improving care coordination with social services and other services, improving efforts to link and retain patients in care, and finally, improving adherence with medication that addresses problems with drug resistance. Another area of priority in this overall category includes children that have high risk for dental disease. This population includes Medicaid and CHIP beneficiaries who are identified with having high risk through risk assessment tools. Examples of the cost drivers, all of which can be greatly reduced with good preventative services, include emergency department visits, surgery in the operating rooms, and overutilization of restorative services. As I mentioned, these things can be greatly reduced through improved prevention and good maintenance. Some of the opportunities in this area include improved intense prevention and chronic disease management approaches toward childhood caries, fewer surgical interventions, and lower per capita costs. I'll now turn this back to some of my colleagues to describe some of the other areas in this innovation category.
Thank you very much, Mark. Next, we are fortunate to have today with us Brian Samuels, Commissioner of the Administration on Children, Youth, and Families. Commissioner Samuels.
Great, thanks, and good afternoon to everyone. Next slide. Next slide. Again, sorry. children known to the child welfare system, as well as adolescents in crisis, have complex health care needs. For example, of the 400,000 children who are in the child welfare system, 23% of them have at least one chronic health condition. Moreover, children who have any mental health services have a much higher prevalence of chronic health disease. For example, the age group 6 to 10 years old has a chronic health condition rate of almost 54%. Trauma and maltreatment have a particular impact on both health and development of children. The literature suggests that child trauma can present with many of the same symptoms that children who have a mental health diagnosis. Treating trauma first rather than starting with a mental illness diagnosis may yield better outcomes for children who are in foster care or adolescents in crisis. Children in foster care, adolescents in crisis, are served by multiple public systems, but share very high prevalences of maltreatment experiences, as well as having had multiple types of maltreatment. Psychotropic medication is also very prevalent in the child welfare population. Children who are in the child welfare system are three times more likely to be using psychotropic medications than the general Medicaid child population. In addition to that, there is significant geographic variation in the rate of prescription of psychotropic medications across the states, with the range being from 1% to 22%, and the median being approximately 13%. Children in the foster care system represent about 3% of the Medicaid child population. However, they represent 38% of the total Medicaid expenditure for children. An average state spends three times more on this population than on the general Medicaid population. Children in child welfare had approximately $4,336 for their cost of care in 1 year versus less than $1,400 for the general child population. Moreover, the cost of psychotropic medications exceeds $1,400 annually, which is 50 to 75% more than non-foster care Medicaid children or enrollees. Improving outcomes. We see this grant opportunity as a unique opportunity to transform and focus on positive outcomes for children who are in the foster care system or adolescents who are in crisis. Improving outcomes for both of these populations is possible. These outcomes include things like reduced trauma symptoms, improved functioning both in physical, social, emotional, and cognitive domains. Again, for example, a trauma-first approach may in fact produce better results than usual care. An intergenerational approach may in fact produce better outcomes than usual care. Or an evidence-based approach to behavioral health services may produce better outcomes for both children known to the child welfare system as well as adolescents in crisis. By using data to drive decision-making and innovation, we would expect proposals to be able to, one, address the complex clinical needs by integrating both physical health and behavioral health, leverage EPSDT to provide validated, trauma-informed screening and assessment, intervening effectively by implementing evidence-based or evidence-informed psychosocial interventions, improving the quality by using standard measures of care, and sharing information across child-serving agencies. We think all of these are represented in this opportunity, and we're really excited about and expect to see some really innovative approaches to meeting the needs of children who are involved in the foster care system or who are adolescents and in crisis. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Samuels. Next, Mimi Toomey, Director of the Office of Policy Analysis and Development at the Administration for Community Living, will present on long-term services and support. Mimi.
Thank you very much. The Administration for Community Living is a newer operating division within the Department of Health and Human Services. It brings together the longstanding efforts of the and achievements of the Administration on Aging, the Administration on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities, and the HHS Office on Disability. So what are long-term services and supports? Well, they basically help older adults and people with disabilities accomplish their everyday tasks. Tasks include assistance with daily activities of daily living, personal care such as eating and bathing, instrumental activities of daily living such as shopping, laundry, and transportation. Medicaid is primarily the largest payer of LTSS, but not the only payer. Other payers include the VA, through the Administration on Aging's Older Americans Act, private pay. A lot of this is fragmented, though, and could be more coordinated within the community. Also, many states under the Medicaid side are rethinking their delivery systems under Medicaid LTSS for services including Medicaid managed care. A variety of groups provide these services, LTSS in the community, from for-profit to non-profit, independent providers of personal care, home care agencies, Centers for Independent Living, area agencies on aging, aging and disability resource centers, just to name a few. LTSS is the acronym for long-term services and supports, and they are directly related to health and health outcomes. We've heard a lot of discussion around avoidable, preventable hospital readmissions. And a major focus, a number of studies have come out that have demonstrated that social determinants of health impact readmissions. In fact, one study found that 40 to 50% of readmissions were linked to social issues and the lack of community coordination and linkages. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. So who are these users? This slide depicts the distribution of community residents and healthcare spending by select groups. The co-occurrence of chronic conditions and functional limitation has wide-reaching consequences for the healthcare system, the individuals, and the economy. So as you can see from this slide, 14% of the population represents 46% of the spending. So effective treatment and coordination across healthcare and social service systems may offer a high-yield strategy to improve lives and control spending. Next slide, please. Next slide. So how do we do this? As you can see, through partnerships, we do outreach and education to professionals, and through services, we do outreach and education to consumers and caregivers. This is just a snapshot of the types of partnerships and services that take place in the community. Others include adult protective services and the protection and advocacy organizations. Other services could be legal assistance and financial aid. So it's a wide range of providers, long-term service support providers, that really together in coordination can be person-centered. Next slide, please. So we went through the HHS Aging and Disability Resource Center care transition programs that critical connections are needed to long-term services and supports in the community post-hospital discharge. This slide provides a snapshot of data from sites that served over 700 people who ended up needing over 2,000 different types of services, long-term services and supports. And you can see from the slide the types of services that they need, and including caregiver support. We know from research that 50% of Medicare beneficiaries who are readmitted within 30 days do not see an outpatient physician after their first hospitalization. Evidence-based care transition models address this issue by helping or coaching individuals to schedule their appointments. The LTSS providers doing evidence-based care transition programs are also trained from their community work to ask additional questions like, how are you going to get to your appointment and do you need transportation? And provide those linkages to the resources to reduce the community barriers for smooth transition. Next slide, please. Next slide. This slide shows that high-risk Medicare beneficiaries without Medicaid look like those with Medicaid, except their high health costs put them on the fast track to Medicaid spend down and more expensive costs to within states. So their status can change very quickly with just one health episode. Next slide, please. Next slide. Thank you. So there's a lot of opportunities for long-term service and supports. We need to better integrate the health systems with families and community supports by setting up high-performing system that supports the infrastructure and coordinate with the long-term service and support systems, providing less fragmentation, that the language is understandable to the individuals and their families, and they all have timely and clear information to make their decisions. We're kind of looking at there's a no-wrong-door model for all populations for information and access to both their community but their health needs. Long-term services and supports that will allow for an individual with a disability to gain meaningful employment and be a contributing member of society through the right supports at their home and in the community, using evidence-based practices and quality. Using a person-centered approach that allows people with needs in the community to receive services in the setting of their choice through home and community-based settings or what is the best setting for them and from the providers they choose and regardless of the source of payment or location. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mimi. Moving along, Suzanne Fields, Senior Advisor on Healthcare Financing at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, will next go over integration for persons with serious behavioral and physical health needs. Suzanne?
Thank you very much. I will be highlighting information regarding persons with mental health and substance use needs and providing some data related to those needs. We've separated the information by adults as well as children and youth. While there are some similarities between those age groups related to behavioral health and physical health integration, there are also some important differences that I want to highlight in terms of your planning. First, looking at data related to adults, over two-thirds of adults with a mental illness have a comorbid physical health condition such as diabetes, heart disease, or COPD. Additionally, we know that adults over the age of 18 with any mental illness within the past year were more likely to have high blood pressure, asthma, diabetes, heart disease, and stroke. In addition, we have some very compelling data specific to certain types of behavioral health conditions and the co-occurring physical health conditions, such as individuals who are experiencing major depression. We also know that persons with mental health issues are more likely to use an emergency room or be hospitalized than individuals who do not have a mental health issue. Now, moving to slide 48, this particular table provides some additional detail related to certain types of physical health conditions and their presence among people who have any type of mental illness, persons who may have a serious mental illness, and then again, specific to the behavioral health condition of depression, looking specifically at the data related to comorbid physical health conditions. Moving on to slide 49, we've provided also from our NISDU, or our National Surveys on Drug Use and Health Data, information related to past year emergency room use, as well as past year hospitalization rates, again, among adults with some type of serious mental illness. And as you can see from this particular data, persons with a serious mental illness are presenting at emergency rooms more frequently for both physical health and behavioral health conditions and are being hospitalized at greater rates. Moving on to slide 50, this slide presents some information, again, specific to adults related to costs for both physical health conditions, for no physical health conditions, as well as the presence of one, two, or three chronic health conditions, comparing mental health service users, substance abuse service users, compared to all other Medicaid beneficiaries. And as you can see from this particular cost data, there are important and significant opportunities to be looking at health outcomes and costs for persons with mental health and substance use. On the next slide, slide 51, I wanted to highlight some information specific to children and youth. Again, there are some similarities in needs with adults, but there are some important differences to consider as part of planning and opportunities. From our data, we know that approximately 1 in 5 young people have a mental, emotional, or behavioral health disorder at an estimated annual cost of $247 billion. We know that approximately 1 in every 4 pediatric primary care office visits involve some type of behavioral or mental health problem that a youth, child, or family is seeking support for. We know that about 1 in every 3 Medicaid-enrolled children who use behavioral health care also have some type of medical condition. The data shows primary condition being asthma, but there are a range of other conditions that children also do present with. In contrast to adults, Medicaid expenditures for children with comorbid conditions are not necessarily driven by physical health needs. They tend to be driven more by behavioral health needs. So it's an important distinction. It makes sense given the developmental trajectory of children, given that many chronic conditions are not yet present in children. So we do know that while well child visits, addressing acute care needs, and in some instances such as asthma, chronic health care needs are important integrative focuses, areas of focus. It's also important to know that the data shows that it's behavioral health issues and expenditures that tend to drive the Medicaid costs. And as such, as planning and consideration of opportunities occurs, integrated care strategies for children need to differ slightly from adults and need to focus more on social supports, community supports, positive educational opportunities and success, in addition to physical health care coordination. Moving on to the last slide related to opportunities to address the needs of persons with behavioral health conditions. New financing models, again, to focus on integrated care for persons with serious behavioral health needs. As the data demonstrates, there are many opportunities to improve both physical health outcomes, behavioral health outcomes, and, of course, address costs. Additional delivery models to coordinate and integrate those physical health and behavioral health treatment needs with a particular focus on the inclusion of broader social, educational, and employment supports. In addition, given the data about hospitalization use and ER use, an emphasis on crisis services, crisis stabilization, mobile outreach teams are also very important in terms of addressing the healthcare needs of this population. time on this particular webinar limited our ability to highlight a range of data that we have available on the SAMHSA website, but similar data is available related to persons experiencing substance use, and there are significant opportunities to address the needs of persons with substance use disorders related to their physical health outcomes and their behavioral health outcomes and improving costs to the system. Opportunities need to include or can include a focus on the patient or the client's primary needs, inclusion of family and other social supports to help reinforce and help them meet their health outcome goals. And finally, as data and outcomes are considered, there is also an important opportunity to include functional outcomes. In addition to looking at physical health outcomes and behavioral health outcomes, such as stability of those particular diagnoses, it's also important to be thinking about stable living situations, success or in school or employment opportunities, and finally, meaningful ties to the community, to families, and to friendships versus social isolation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Suzanne. I just want to thank all of our guest speakers who have presented thus far. Our final presenter will be Aparna Saha, Senior Advisor in the Policy and Programs Group at the Innovation Center, and she will preview the upcoming webinars for the Healthcare Innovation Awards Round 2. Aparna?
Thank you, Andrew. Today, we provided an overview of Categories 1 and 2. As many of you have seen, next Tuesday, the 18th, we'll provide an overview of Categories 3 and 4. We would like to also announce the remaining webinars for the series. We'll be presenting on the total cost of care and how to achieve lower costs through improvement. On this webinar, we'll also review the cost categories in the financial plan and submitting a letter of intent. Next, we'll present on performance measures and how to develop an operational plan. We'll also host a webinar on payment models and another one on the application narrative and its components. Finally, we'll provide technical assistance on submitting an application on the last webinar. The dates and times will be announced on our listserv and on our website at innovation.cms.gov. In terms of next steps, letters of intent are due June 28th. The LOI, which is a web-based form, is currently available online on our website. Please don't wait until the last minute in case there are any issues that arise as you're trying to submit your LOI. Now, in addition to the LOI, we'll be providing additional resources on innovation categories, payment models, and frequently asked questions. We will post these on our website at innovation.cms.gov, so please check back frequently. And if you have not registered for your Dun & Bradstreet number, please do so immediately. We have heard that there may be a lag time to get this number, and it's required for submitting your application. And similarly, please register in the System for Award Management at the website listed on the slide. Now, if there are any questions that we're not able to get to today, please don't hesitate to email the team at innovationawards@cms.hhs.gov. And with that, I'll turn it back to Andrew.
Thank you, Aparna. Next, we will begin the question and answer section of the webinar. Before we get to our first question, there is another important bit of information to emphasize. We are unable to provide you or your organization with feedback regarding proposals or ideas during this procurement-sensitive time period. We are also unable to meet with any applicants during this time period. This is to ensure the integrity and equity of this competitive funding opportunity. If you meet with CMS Innovation Center staff during this time period, you may be deemed ineligible for funding in Healthcare Innovation Awards Round 2. Now we are ready to begin with the first question. First question reads, the FOA states that models primarily focused on acute hospital inpatient care are excluded from this round and will not be reviewed. Can you clarify? Going to hand this over to my colleague, Sheila Hanley. Sheila?
So this funding opportunity is focused on innovative payment and service delivery models in non-inpatient settings. We do expect, however, that proposals falling within any of the four given innovation categories may result in improved outcomes and reduced costs in the inpatient setting.
Great. Thank you, Sheila. Moving on to our second question. If our proposal projects that most or all savings to the total cost of care will accrue from reduced inpatient costs due to our proposed outpatient care model, are we still eligible to apply for this round? Sheila, I'm going to hand this one over to you.
The funding opportunity announcement indicates that we are not seeking applications primarily focused on service and payment reforms occurring in the inpatient setting. If the primary focus of your model is to reduce acute hospitalizations, then it does not meet the criteria of the FOA. We do expect that proposals falling within any of the four given innovation categories may result in improved outcomes and lower costs in the inpatient setting. Reductions in inpatient costs may be counted in projecting your total cost of care savings.
Great. Thank you, Sheila. Okay, our next question. In the FOA, it states organizations may apply as conveners that assemble and coordinate the efforts of a group of participants. Can you help us better understand the role of the convener? Aparna?
Sure. Thank you. So organizations that assemble and coordinate the efforts of a group of participants may apply as conveners. And in this case, the convener is synonymous with a lead applicant.
Thank you, Aparna. Okay. Moving along to our next question. Is it advisable for organizations requesting less than $10 million to obtain and submit an external actuarial certification of their financial plan? Aparna, I'm going to hand this over to you as well.
So applicants requesting less than $10 million in funding, they're encouraged, but they're not required to submit an external actuarial certification. Now, the financial plan must be reviewed and certified by the chief financial officer of the applicant's organization, and that chief financial officer cannot be the executive director.
Okay. Moving along to our next question. Will preference be given to applicants to submit an application that cuts across multiple innovation categories? Sheila, I'm going to hand this to you.
Applicants are asked to identify a primary innovation category in which to be considered, but may use the narrative section of the application to identify other innovation categories that may be relevant to their model. The FOA doesn't indicate either an advantage or a disadvantage for proposals that relate to more than one innovation category. Your application will be reviewed against the criteria listed in the FOA.
Okay, next question going to, looks like, Suzanne Fields. What does the $247 billion cost associated with the 1 in 5 youth that have a behavioral health disorder entail? Is this spending on mental health services, or is it total health care costs for this population? Suzanne?
Hi, yes, thank you. So that particular cost references total cost to the system for children. It is not specific to mental health or substance use conditions.
Great. Thank you, Suzanne. Okay, moving along. Can the AOR or organization initiating the letter of intent change the AOR and lead organization for the proposal in the final submittal? I'm going to aim this question to Christy. Christy?
Hi, yes. The organization that submits the letter of intent can change in the final application. We just ask that you keep consistent with the assigned letter of intent number that you're given when you submit the letter of intent.
Great. Next question. The dual Medicaid-Medicare beneficiaries to be included as a specific category of its own or not? going to turn this over to Sean. Sean, can you just repeat the question? Are dual Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries to be included as a specific category of, on its own or not?
So the answer is yes.
They are not specifically identified in the four innovation categories in the FOA. However, I would say that this is a population that is important to the Innovation Center and CMS. They're both populations that, that are eligible for this FOA. So if your model otherwise fits in one of the four innovation categories and they are the target population, you would be eligible.
Okay, moving along. Our next question. The LOI asks for a list of partners. Is preference given to applicants with multiple partners? Sheila?
Yes. The FOA directs that preference will be given to applications with multiple partners, multiple payer partners.
Great. And another question for you, Sheila. Since the emphasis in this round is payment models, do we have to have a payer involved with our application to CMS?
The applications will be reviewed against the preferences and the scoring criteria in the FOA. The FOA states a preference for strong payer involvement and the requirement for the submission of a payment model. The absence of payer involvement may be a factor in the competitiveness of your proposal.
Great. Next question. Please confirm if hospice is considered a priority area under Category 1, and will it be given preference? Sheila? Oh, excuse me. We're going to go partner for this one.
Yes, we consider hospice as fitting into the priority area in Category 1 in post-acute care services.
Great. Thank you, Aparna. Okay, moving along. Next question. Looking at the relationship between trauma and health presented by Commissioner Samuels, will applications that prevent trauma in early childhood before entry into foster care meet this priority, or is the goal to reduce cost of treatment in foster care? Commissioner Samuels, you want to take a stab at this one?
Sure. So again, you know, our primary interest is recognizing the significant cost for children who have already been maltreated and for whom a particular set of interventions are needed to move them back to positive functioning. Beyond that, it's not clear to me that simply preventing maltreatment is in and of itself a category of spending where there is significant cost currently going towards. So it's not clear to me that that would qualify, but I'm certainly open to a discussion with folks at CMMI on that.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Okay, next question. Is the Innovation Center interested in projects that are small in scope and population, but with a model that can be widely replicated? Aparna?
Yes, absolutely. Please submit your applications and make the best case for your models, and we will consider the application regardless of the size.
Okay, our next question. Can more than one priority area be addressed within one innovation category? Go to Christy.
Yes, you can address more than one priority area as listed in the funding opportunity announcements within one category.
Great, thank you. Okay, our next question. please describe the level of detail that is required for the new payment models that must be included in our application? Sheila?
So all applicants must submit as part of their application the design of a payment model that's consistent with the new service delivery model that they're requesting funding for. The payment model design must include Medicare, Medicaid, and/or CHIP, though it should ideally include other payers as well. The payment model design should include a description of how funds would flow under the model, a description of the specific provider or beneficiary incentives the payment model would create, a description of risk parameters, a description of how the payment model would deliver a positive return on investment for CMS, and a description of how the parameters of the payment model would progress over time. And those factors are articulated in the FOA. We'd also remind you, as Aparna mentioned a few minutes ago, we will be having a specific webinar on the payment model with additional information.
Great. Thank you, Sheila. Moving along, our next question. At what point must the new payment system be in place? From inception of the three-year period, or what period of time exactly? Sheila, do you want to answer this one?
Sure. So applicants must submit the design of a payment model as part of their application. Applicants have the option to submit as part of their application a detailed and fully developed payment model, as well as a list of payers interested in testing the new payment model and the service delivery model. However, there is no assumption that a model would be operationalized within the performance period.
Okay, thank you. Okay, moving along, it's going to go to Christy for this one. On page 11 of the grant, it is stated that the metrics will be jointly developed by awardees and CMS. How do applicants include evaluation measures up front in the application? Christy?
Sure, and we'll be covering this later in future webinars on the application, but one of the supplemental materials is an operational plan, which includes a measurement section, which allows you to pick some measures from an approved CMS list, as well as stipulating your own measures. In addition, in the application, there's a narrative around that. So there'll be a couple places for you to describe the measures that you're going to include in your application.
Great. Moving along, another question. The LOI instructs that one category be selected, but in prior webinar, we were told that all categories could be addressed in a strong application. Could you please clarify?
Sure. So in the letter of intent, we do force you to select the one best fit answer for your project in terms of the innovation category. However, in the application, you'll be able to select your secondary categories so that you can describe the full scope of your project. In order to get information on the types of projects, we are asking for a single entry on the LOI.
Okay. Next question. If a proposed project includes incentive payments to providers to change behavior, should the funding request include an estimate of the total amount of estimated incentive payments?
The answer is yes. Your budget should include all expenses that are not otherwise billable to Medicare, Medicaid, or CHIP, including these. We would caution, though, that any time you're providing payments such as this, people should be aware of applicable federal program integrity, fraud, and abuse laws, and just be conversant. Thank you.
Okay. Next question. Do both companies intending to partner on a proposal need to file an LOI? Christy?
Organizations can submit multiple proposals, provided that they submit a separate letter of intent for each proposal. However, if two companies are partnering on one project, only one letter of intent is needed for that application. One organization will take the lead on the proposal and identify itself as the lead, and then others will be considered as partners to that application.
Thank you, Christy. Okay, another question. Will CMS provide a list of recommended financial actuaries? Parna?
CMS will not provide a list of recommended financial actuaries. However, the actuary must be a qualified member of the American Academy of Actuaries.
Okay, I've been quite a few questions coming in. Okay, our next question. Is there a certain amount of money allocated to each category? Christy, you want to take that one?
No specific amount of funding has been allocated to any category at this time. CMS estimates that there will be approximately 100 awards with a range of approximately $1 million to $30 million per award. However, CMS is not obligated to fund a minimum number of applications, nor are we required to distribute a minimum amount of funds available for the second round of the Healthcare Innovation Awards.
Thank you, Christy. Okay, next question. What if we don't have multiple payers signed on at the submission of our application? Sheila?
Applications must include a feasible approach for securing participation of multiple payers for their proposed payment model. We will be giving preference to applications that include participation by non-CMS payers at the outset of the model's implementation.
Okay, another question. I know that you can't receive funding for any model being tested under another CMS initiative. But if you are expanding a model funded under round one to reach a different population and add major new components, would that be acceptable? Sheila?
Yes. Expansion of a model funded under round one to reach a different population and with major new components would be considered eligible. We would draw your attention, though, to the FOA and the deciding official criteria, which include the range of service delivery and payment models proposed and the fit with the current CMS portfolio, and encourage you to make your strongest case.
Thank you, Sheila. Based on question 27 of the letter of intent, can a potential proposal service multiple insurance status types? For instance, could a proposal be directed towards both Medicaid and uninsured customers? If so, is there a threshold for the percentage that must be CMS beneficiaries? For example, would a proposal that contains 55% Medicaid recipients and 45% uninsured be acceptable? Aparna, I'm going to hand this one over to you.
Sure. Proposals may indirectly benefit patients other than those covered by Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP. However, CMS funds are to be used to directly target Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP beneficiaries. Now, CMS understands that some investments made to benefit the Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP patients may have spillover benefits to other patients. Now, if a proposal is specifically targeted at benefiting other populations, CMS looks to see whether other payers are contributing proportionally to the cost of the model. We do emphasize that an intervention or proposal that directly funds explicitly towards non-Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP patients is not allowable.
Thank you, Aparna. Okay, our next question. Regarding scope, is the Innovation Center interested in projects that are relatively small in scope, population served, but with a model that can be widely and successfully replicated? Aparna?
Sure. I'm sorry. I think we might have already gone through that one. Yes, we will be looking at applications that are small in scope as long as it could be replicable. We don't have a bottom threshold on the size.
Great. Thank you for that. Okay, moving along, next question. The letter of intent form asks for a list of partners. Is preference given to the application with multiple partners? I think we already answered that one.
And Andrew, just to repeat the response to that question, yes, preference is given to applications with multiple payer partners.
Our next question, can you please define FMI? Suzanne, can you take this one?
Certainly I can. So SMI stands for serious mental illness. Other terms for children would be specific to serious emotional disturbance. There are definitions for both of those within the Public Health Service Act. Those definitions can be found at our website, SAMHSA.gov. Again, for both SMI, for serious emotional disturbance in children, as well as a definition for substance use disorder. Again, that website is SAMHSA.gov.
Thank you, Suzanne. Okay. All right, so we are starting to run short on time. So with that being said, we're going to have to wrap up the question answer segment of the webinar. And before we do that, I'm going to hand it over to Sheila for a closing statement. Sheila?
So I just want to end by thanking our colleagues from CMS and HHS for joining us for today's webinar, as well as those of you who have taken the time to join us this afternoon. We appreciate the important work that you're doing to transform our healthcare system, and we look forward to receiving your innovative proposals and ideas and to addressing your innovative ideas that will address the areas and issues that we've discussed this afternoon. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sheila. That concludes the question and answer section of the webinar. We ask that attendees please fill out the participant survey accessible via the link appearing now through their webinar portal. We value participant feedback throughout the webinar process. The CMS Innovation Center will be hosting additional webinars related to specific aspects of the Healthcare Innovation Award Round 2 application process. We encourage all potential applicants to sign up for the CMS Innovation Center listserv on our website to stay abreast of the latest webinar announcement dates and details. Thank you all for attending today, and have a good afternoon. Goodbye.